The following message was preached at Redeemer Community Church. For more information about Redeemer, visit us online at www.redeemernc.org.
Today's scripture reading comes from Ecclesiastes 5:8-12. If you see oppression of the poor and perversion of justice and righteousness in the province, don't be astonished at the situation, because the official protects another official, and higher officials protect them. The profit of the land is taken by all. The king is served by the field. The one who loves silver is never satisfied with silver, and whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with income. This, too, is futile. When good things increase, the ones who consume them multiply. What, then, is the profit to the owner except to gaze at them with his eyes? The sheep of the worker is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich permits him no sleep. This is the word of the Lord.
You may be seated. Thanks, Kate. So if you were watching the evening news, I know no one does that anymore, but just imagine you were watching the evening news and the news anchor came on and said, next we have a story of a heartbreaking tragedy. A heartbreaking tragedy. What kind of story would you expect to come next? Right, maybe you would say that maybe it'd be a story about some sort of natural disaster that ravaged a town. But possibly a story about a famous person who received a terminal diagnosis or a senseless murder, a house that caught on fire. Like, these are the types of things that come to our mind when we hear the word tragedy. But what if the story that followed the statement, next, the story of a heartbreaking tragedy, what if the story were this? A couple wins the lottery. A salesman, he closes a big deal. An executive receives his annual bonus. Would you be surprised? See, our text this morning uses the word tragedy four times. It does it twice in chapter 5, twice in chapter 6. But it doesn't use it where we would expect it to use it. In each case, it uses it in conjunction with some measure of financial success. Like, is it possible that making money and being financially successful could be a tragedy for you? Now, we tend to think of money in black and white terms, right? Having more of it, that's positive. Having less of it, that's negative. It's as simple as that. But is it? I mean, we're almost halfway through the book of Ecclesiastes, and we should realize now that it's never as simple as that. Life has much greater complexity. More money is not always better than less money. And on the flip side, less money is not necessarily better than more money. In the second half of chapter 5 and then in chapter 6, the teacher explains in detail what the rapper, the notorious B.I.G., said more simply: mo' money, mo' problems. Money is not the savior we think it is. Money is not the solution to the problems we face. The teacher here, he's not telling us that money is our problem, and so we should be poor. He's not offering that simple of a solution to what ails us. Here's what he's warning us. He's warning us not to listen to that little voice deep inside our brains that assures us that all of our problems would go away if we simply had a little more money. Have you ever had that thought? Have you ever sat down to pay the bills? Or been driving your car daydreaming and you just hear yourself saying somewhere deep inside that if I could just make a little more money, if I just have a little more money, then life would just be so much easier, it'd be better, everything would be fine. He wants us in these verses to see that money can't fix the brokenness around us and it can't fix the brokenness inside us. And the way he does it is to show us that there are problems that can come with the accumulation of money. We think more money would simplify our lives, and the opposite is often true. Now, I want to reiterate this at the start. Like, it's not wrong to make money. In fact, I pray that some of you would make a lot of money, and you would use it for kingdom causes. Like, you heard about the camp in Moldova. That was built because Christians who made money both in Moldova and in the States partnering with them gave that money so that 1,300 children could hear the gospel at camp this summer. So money in itself is not wrong. Money can be used in great ways. God gives his people money so that they'll use that money for his purposes. But I do want to warn you about how ineffective money is to fix our problems, our real problems. Money often works like an amplifier. If you've ever picked up an electric guitar and you strum it, it doesn't make much noise. You can barely hear it. But if you plug it into an amp, you can hear nothing else, sometimes for days. That's what money does. If you have problems without money, whatever those problems are, they often grow more prominent. They're amplified once you get money. Like, money doesn't solve discontentment. Money doesn't solve despair. So here's the bottom line. Making more money might actually be a tragedy, not a blessing, because more money brings more problems. Our text reveals five problems that can come with making more money. So if you're ever tempted to think, this is what it's targeting, if you're ever tempted to think that money will solve all your problems, remember, that's not true. Money can create problems too. So here's problem number one. More money, more temptation. More money, more temptation. Okay, money, we got to understand why we like it. It's power. So if you want to travel to visit Anatole and Nadia and see the camp this summer, it requires money. Money gives you the power to make the trip. If you go to the airport without any money, right, you don't have the power to get to Moldova to visit the camp. If this summer you want heat, if the winter you want air conditioning, right, it requires money. Money makes it makes it possible for you to condition your house, to adjust the temperature. You run out of money, and there are certain companies out there who say, well, you no longer have control over the temperature in your house. We cut it off. So money is power. Money gives you the ability to accomplish and control things that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. And with that power comes temptation. Look at verse 8. Let me read this again. If you see oppression of the poor and perversion of justice and righteousness in the province, now we expect it to say, go do something about it. That's not what it says. We're told other places to help the poor, but that's not what it says here. It says this, don't be astonished at this. Don't be surprised by this. Why? Because one official protects another official, and higher officials protect them. That's not surprising. Look around. The profit from the land is taken by all. The king is served by the field. The one who loves silver is never satisfied with silver, and whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with income. This too is futile. Now, how are we supposed to use power? Jesus told his disciples that the typical way that humans use power is for their own benefit. So we get some level of position of power, authority, and we use it to lord over people. And he says eventually we become tyrants. Right? We get a small taste of power, and we like the flavor. Now, that tastes good, so we want a little more, and eventually we get drunk on power. Then we do whatever is required to hold on to that power. Now, of course, Jesus says this is not how his disciples should view power. He says, any level of power or authority I give you, you should use to serve others, right? To fulfill the second greatest commandment. We use power, we use money, we use authority and influence as his disciples to love our neighbors as ourselves. But that's not what we see in the world, and that's what the same thing the teacher is saying here. Those who gain power, and the connection here is that power usually comes with money or through money. What do? Well, they oppress the poor and they pervert justice. They make deals, verse 8 tells us, with other powerful people to protect each other, to consolidate power. And so instead of allowing, verse 9, the workers to receive the benefit from the land, everyone in power takes a piece. And the worst offender is the king, right, who taxes the land for his own benefit. And why does this happen? Verse 10 tells us because the powerful rich are never satisfied. They won't give up their power easily. In fact, they want more and more power. So I want you to think about when Israel was begging the prophet Samuel for a king. Now understand, they had a king. Their king was God. And God was the perfect king because God didn't need anything from them. God was the one giving to them. He was providing for them. He was meeting their needs. This is what a king is supposed to do. But they looked around and they're like, all these other countries have kings. And so, Samuel, we want a king like the other nations. And so Samuel warned them, if you want a king who acts like the kings of the other nations, you'll get a king who acts like the kings of the other nations. And what does that mean? He says, this is what will happen. That king will start taking your stuff. First, he'll take your sons and put them in his armies. Then he'll take your daughters and make them his servants. Then he'll take the best orchards you have and the best vineyards and the best cattle. And finally, he says he's going to take whatever he wants from you and he's going to give it to his favorites. Well, we still want a king. They get a king. Guess what he does? He starts taking their stuff. I mean, this is what happens throughout human history. Human history is an unbroken string of the poor being oppressed by the rich. And this happens in governments, happens in businesses, happens in churches, happens in schools, happens in families. Like, people are like sharks. They smell blood in the water. They attack. They consume. The more they get, the more tempted they are to take even more. Why do you think God gives a person money? Well, he gives money so that we can bless others, especially those who have less than we have. I want you to listen to this command God gives to landowners. This is from Leviticus. He says this, when you reap the harvest of your land, you are not to reap to the very edge of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not strip your vineyard bare or gather its fallen grapes. Leave them for the poor and the resident alien. Here's what he's saying. The more money you have, the more stuff, the more possessions, the more you need to be generous with those needs. So if you have big fields, like, leave some of it so that those who don't have any fields, who don't have any crops or any fruit, they can come and they can pick from it and they can be taken care of. But what happens is the opposite. The more power we have, the more money we get, the more money we get, the more power we have to get more money. And this cycle continues. And so here he's saying what human nature is going to do, that rich man is going to look out at his field, he's going to start calculating. There's a way I can maximize profit here, maybe even rationalize it. I can be more efficient here as a business owner if I have my people, my servants, go to the very edges of the field. Look at how much money I'm losing. Look at how much profit is left there on the field and leaves the poor with nothing. Let me ask you, if you make more money, will you be content? What is the dollar figure you need to make to be content? Let's write it down. What is it? If you get there, you'll be content, right? If you get there, never want another thing. That's just, there's this perfect amount. Or is it possible you'd get there and you like some of the things you can now purchase? In fact, the more you like them, the more you get a taste for them. And you're like, well, there's some other things I'd like. So now my dollar figure creeps up. Now I need this to be content. In other words, are you prepared, Christian, for the increased temptation that comes with increased wealth? So the first problem that comes with more money is more temptation. Temptation to use your money for yourself instead of for others. Here's problem number two. More money, more anxiety. So we talk about, when you think about professional athletes in our day and age, one of the things you think about right away is the salaries, right? Just the astronomical salaries. Sometimes you see it broken down like by minute. This person earns this per minute. Like, you know how many zeros there'd be between the decimal point and the number for us if we did it by minute? Right, this is it. But did you realize this? 3 out of 4 retired NFL players either declares bankruptcy or is in severe financial stress. 3 out of 5, 60% of NBA basketball players are broke within 5 years of retirement. Now, there's a lot of reasons why that may be, but one of the reasons is that if you hear their stories is because as soon as they made money, people came like leeches and sucked them dry. In fact, I was reading about one former athlete who described how he went to his hometown for his grandmother's funeral, and he says he pulls in towards the funeral and there are cars surrounding the block, and he's like, my grandmother knew no one. She stayed at home all the time. What happened is he left the funeral and he said people ran up to him pushing proposals and letters and things to him, trying to get him to financially help them. This is what the teacher describes in verse 11. Notice what he says. When good things increase, the ones who consume them multiply. What then is the profit to the owner except to gaze at them with his eyes? The sleep of the worker is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich permits him no sleep. So the more money you have, the more people you're responsible for. Like if your business grows, so does your number of employees. And now you're responsible for their welfare. Often as a business grows, you have these financial reports which look so good, but the owner, if they were being honest, says, all I see are stress and worry. And that's his point here in verse 11. He's like, the only good thing seems to be the bottom line. It's fun to look at, but it keeps you awake at night. And so he makes this interesting contrast in verse 12. Here's this man who's a hard worker. He's not prominent. He's not wealthy, but he goes to work. He works hard all day. He comes back, and sometimes he doesn't have enough to be really full, but he goes to sleep, and he sleeps well. He's like, that's better than the guy who eats the steak. He drinks the wine. He has the nice dessert, and he goes home, and he lays in bed, and his between the stomach problems and between his anxious mind, he never sleeps at all. You know, maybe you're in a job that is not one of those jobs that people esteem highly in our culture. They're one of those jobs that maybe you think people look down on. And so you're tempted in your own heart to a level of discontentment. Maybe you're the guy who works hard, doesn't always have enough. Look, the teacher is challenging your own self-perception. Like, it is a gift from God to be able to go home from a hard day of labor and sleep the sleep of the exhausted. The most important job for you to do is the job that God has given you. And the fact that God has given it to you gives that job value and worth. See, when we evaluate jobs, we so often boil them down to how much money is made. And let me say, brothers and sisters, that is a terrible barometer for determining value. Like taking a job solely for money, I want you to hear this. Taking a job solely for the amount of money it could make may be doing harm to your soul. In fact, for some of us, holding on to more money is like storing nuclear waste in our closet. It slowly poisons us. What we think is valuable is killing us. Look at verse 13. I want you to see this verse. There is a sickening tragedy. Pause. That's pretty bad, right? Can we agree? Sickening tragedy is that's about as harsh a language as you might be able to use. What is a sickening tragedy? I have seen under the sun. Wealth kept by its owner to his harm. Do you believe that verse? Do you believe that it is possible that making more money could be hazardous to your health? Think of this verse like the Surgeon General's warning on a pack of cigarettes. Right? Do you ignore it and keep inhaling? I'll be fine. Is it possible for money to be harmful to your spiritual health? Do you believe that? Do you care? So Jesus told his famous parable of the soils. And this is a well-known story he told. And he compares there the heart to soil, and he compares the gospel to a seed. And he says what happens is sometimes when the seed of the gospel is put in the soil of the human heart, there's a lot of different possible outcomes he talks about, but one particular one he talks about is, for a moment it looks like it's going to bring forth fruit, but then weeds grow up and weeds choke out that plant, and so it never actually bears fruit. So in other words, what he's saying, right, is that it's possible for someone to hear the gospel, it looks like they're going to respond, it looks like, hey, they're going to follow Jesus, but then other things happen and all of a sudden they're no longer interested. They walk away. There's no fruit that they're actually a disciple of Jesus. Do you know what he says those weeds are that might choke the gospel from the human heart? Here's what he says in Matthew 13. The worries of this age and the deceitfulness of wealth. Is making money worth losing your soul? Problem number three, more money, more regret. More money, more regret. See, the more you have, the more you have to lose. And if you lose it, that regret can be paralyzing. So here the teacher tells us a story about how painful it can be to lose the money you work so hard to acquire. Verse 14 says that wealth was lost in a bad venture. So when he fathered a son, he was empty-handed. As he came from his mother's womb, so he will go again naked as he came. He will take nothing for his efforts that he can carry in his hands. This too is a sickening tragedy. Exactly as he comes, so he will go. What does the one gain who struggles for the wind? What is more, he eats in darkness all his days with much frustration, sickness, and anger. You see, the person who's never had any money has never had to face the pain of losing it. But the man described in these verses, he's experienced wealth and that wealth is now gone, and so he lives in constant regret. Verse 14 says he's there and he's like, I have nothing to pass down to my kids. All of his efforts, he's gained nothing. Now we see him, verse 17, he's sitting in the dark. And he's sitting there in frustration and anger and bitterness and regret. I don't know if you've ever had the experience I've had where you receive some amount of unexpected money. It doesn't have to be a lot, but it's some amount. Maybe it comes as a gift, a tax return. Have you ever had that where you overpaid your escrow? Which is your money, they're just returning it to you, but you're like, oh, a gift. But you get this, you weren't expecting it, and so all of a sudden you're like, ooh. What can we do with this? You start thinking about maybe something fun or something memorable, something you've been wanting. You're like, hey, this is a part of the budget, so I can use it for this. And you get all excited about it. And just about that time, an unexpected expense comes. Now, what happened in that situation? I would love to say what I do in that situation is say, thank you, Lord. You provided for my need before I even knew I had the need. That is not what I do. Right? I'm like, oh. Are you kidding me? I'd already in my mind spent it. I'd had it. Tasted so good. Now it's gone. So imagine that same feeling multiplied by a factor of 100 or the factor of 1,000. And that's what this man is feeling. He had generational wealth. And now it's gone. And it may have been his fault, but it may not have been. The phrase bad venture doesn't mean he did something wrong. Don't read it as he did something wrong. We're not told a lot, but what are some of the possibilities? Maybe he had invested all of his money in real estate. So in that time, fields. Though he's a smart man, maybe he's even a generous man. He's invested in real estate. He's got fields, and maybe he's doing what Leviticus says, and he's leaving the edges for the poor people. And then there's year one of drought. Okay, I can survive. Year two of drought. Oh no, year three of drought. It's all gone. Or maybe he owns some sort of shop in the village, and he's worked hard, he's stored things away, he's got what he needs for future seasons, and he can keep supplying the store, and he feels like this my son will be able to take this over years from now, and all of a sudden the neighboring country decides to invade, and they invade his town. And he watches from the hills as smoke rises from his store and everything he purchased. Or maybe he's a craftsman, and he's reached sort of the peak of his skill and ability, his highest earning potential, and just then he gets sick. And the sickness affects him in such a way that he can no longer do the work that he had done. Or maybe he simply trusted the wrong person. Maybe it was a good friend, it was a family member who said, like, here, this is great, invest your money with me, and I'll take care of you. And he does. And he finds out he was swindled. Whatever the case, whatever the reason, here he is, and he's just living in this dark room full of regret. Now, the teacher uses a story to remind us that what is true for this man is actually true for all of us. We may not have lost all of our money yet, but we all eventually lose all of our money. We will leave the world, he says, exactly as we entered it, naked. We brought nothing in this world. We take nothing out of this world. I love the picture painted by Christian Bush in his country song. He says, everybody chasing something. I don't know why they're running. I take my time to the finish line because we all end up with nothing. I don't know why. I know why everyone want to die rich. Diamonds, champagne, work your way down that list. We try. Everybody tries to fit into that ditch. You can't take it with you when you go. This is the line I love. Never seen a hearse with a trailer hitch. You can stack it up, pack it up tight with a big red bow, get a great big truck, back it all up, but you can't take it with you when you go. So we look at the man who's lost everything and we pity him, but when we die, we leave it all behind. He just got there sooner. If you spend your life making money, at the end you may regret all of the things you sacrificed to get there. For this reason, the well-known British pastor John Stott encourages us. He says, since our lives are spent between two moments of nakedness, it's best to travel light. Problem three is more money, more regret. Here's problem four. More money, more dissatisfaction. More money, more dissatisfaction. What if God gave you everything you wanted? You would be content then, right? Well, the answer actually depends entirely upon what it is you want. So the teacher, he shows us here the tragedy of getting exactly what you want if what you want are the wrong things. Look at verse 1 of chapter 6. Here is another tragedy, right? He's observed under the sun and it weighs heavily on humanity. God gives a person riches, wealth, and honor so that he lacks nothing of all he desires for himself. But God does not allow him to enjoy them. Instead, a stranger will enjoy them. This is futile and a sickening tragedy. A man may father 100 children and live many years, no matter how long he lives. If he is not satisfied by good things and does not even have a proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For he comes in futility and he goes in darkness, and his name is shrouded in darkness. Though a stillborn child does not see the sun and is not conscious, it has more rest than he. And if a person lives 1,000 years twice, but does not experience happiness, do not both go to the same place? All of a person's labors for his stomach, yet the appetite is never satisfied. I think the key to understanding what he's saying here is verse 2, because notice the phrase. After God gives him riches, wealth, and honor, this phrase, he lacks nothing of all he desires for himself. Okay? He has everything he wanted, because God gave it to him. God withheld nothing of what he wanted, but God doesn't give him satisfaction. Why not? Because that's not what he asked for. He desired riches, he desired reputation, and God granted those wishes. He didn't ask for contentment. Friend, you realize one of the scariest things that God could do for you is to give you what you want? Hell will be filled with people who didn't want God, and God obliged them. Maybe you've heard the German legend about Faust, who makes a bargain with the devil, right? And so he'll give up his soul in exchange for unlimited knowledge and pleasure, and of course, it doesn't make him happy. It makes him miserable, and he regrets the bargain he made. And right, it's the moral of the story is it's this cautionary tale about trading what is most valuable for that which really doesn't matter. But the story of Faust is a fable because the devil doesn't have that kind of power. What's more real and what's more terrifying is that God may give you exactly what you want, and that leaves you in a perpetual state of dissatisfaction. See, brothers and sisters, do you realize here what this story is telling us? Is that God may sometimes prevent you from accumulating money as an act of kindness to you. Just consider that for a moment, that God may be sparing you from some of the pain and misery that comes when you get the things you want but find out they're empty. I mean, this man has it all. And yet he is so dissatisfied that he says, I wish I had never been born. He goes even further and says, in fact, a stillborn child is more fortunate than I have been. Now that's shocking. And honestly, at first read, it feels callous, especially for those who've lost a child. But I want you to notice why he says it. Because two things are true for the stillborn child that are not true for him. First, the stillborn child, though he's not known, is loved. That's the heart of this comparison here. No one mourns the death of this man for all of his stuff. Like, no one mourns his death. No one buries him. But he says, but at least when a child dies in the womb, there are people who love him. That's why it's such a tragedy. That's why we hurt so much, because we love that baby. But no one loves him. His second comparison with the stillborn child is the stillborn child finds rest. This is sweet. Here's what he says. The stillborn child is with God. Yes, he has never known the sun to shine upon his face on a beautiful sunny afternoon. But he's also never known pain and heartbreak and disappointment. And he says, and I wish I could find rest. See, he's not satisfied because he doesn't know rest. This man is like an addict. He always needs a new fix, but no fix ever fixes anything. It just leaves him wanting, craving, longing for more, and each time he's left with less. Do you want more? I really want you to think about that question. Do you want more? Now, here's what I want you to do. If I can ask you that question, what if I were to ask your credit card statement? Do you want more? No, I don't want more. Let me see your credit card statement. Like, would that agree with you or contradict you? Like, do you keep buying stuff, accumulating stuff, hoping that that will satisfy you? Like, when you're a kid and it's candy and Matchbox cars, that's fine. When you're an adult and it's like fancy meals and trips and more cars and nicer cars and newer cars and bigger houses, it's sad. Because that stuff can't satisfy you. In fact, all it will do is make the dissatisfaction grow. All those infomercials on TV end with the same tagline, where they say, satisfaction guaranteed or your money back. I mean, who can guarantee satisfaction? Like, no amount of money, no amount of success, no amount of reputation guarantees satisfaction. What if the person who hears that satisfaction guaranteed or your money back says, I don't want the money back, I just want the satisfaction. There's a story told about John D. Rockefeller, the wealthiest American to ever live, and he was asked, which of your millions is your favorite? And he reportedly said, the next one. More money, more disappointment, more dissatisfaction. Here's problem five. More money, more disillusionment. So I want you to see how chapter six ends. It ends with a series of questions. And if you're reading fast, some you might be like, well, I don't understand. What are the point of these questions? But think of these series of questions as this man who thought that wealth would satisfy him, but it has not. And what happens is when that happens, I keep getting stuff, I keep doing stuff, I keep having experiences and nothing satisfies. What happens is a person begins to question everything. Right? Their wealth, their great wealth hasn't brought them the power they wish they had. In the end, they're realizing rich and poor, wise and foolish, great and small, all still die. And so here they are going like, what difference does this all make? What's the point? So as I read these final verses, here's what I want you to listen for. Listen to the disillusionment that is seeping through these questions. Verse 8. What advantage then does the wise person have over the fool? What advantage is there for the poor person who knows how to conduct himself before others? Better what the eyes see than wandering desire. This too is futile in the pursuit of the wind. Whatever exists was given its name long ago. It's known what mankind is, but he's not able to contend with the one stronger than he. For when there are many words, they increase futility. What is the advantage for mankind? For who knows what is good for anyone in life in the few days of his futile life that he spends like a shadow? Who can tell anyone what will happen after him under the sun? These verses close the first half of the book of Ecclesiastes. And they echo much of what we saw in the opening chapters. The question in verse 12 reminds us of the question that was repeated in chapter 1, in chapter 2, in chapter 3. What have you gained from all your labor? Randy Alcorn, in his book, The Treasure Principle, summarizes our text. This is what he writes. He says, the more you have, the more you want. The more you have, the less you're satisfied. The more you have, the more people will come after it. The more you have, the more you realize it does you no good. The more you have, the more you have to worry about. The more you have, the more you can hurt yourself by holding on to it. The more you have, the more you have to lose. And the more you have, the more you'll leave behind. These are the realities that have caused this teacher to grow disillusioned. What difference does it all make? Yet the answers are hinted at even in the questions. In verse 10, his questions point us back to life in the Garden of Eden, because that's where the things that exist were named long ago. This is where the dissatisfaction, the disillusionment originated. He's pointing us to the source of it. Even his final two questions yield an answer. He asks, who knows what is good? Hey, we know the answer to that question. Who can tell us what will happen? Did you notice that in all this talk of money, who has not been mentioned? All of this talk has been godless, without God. Which is exactly what Adam and Eve did in the garden, right? They wanted to replace God. They wanted life without God. More money brings more problems when money takes the place of God. When we look to money to do for us what only God can do for us. If you think more money is your greatest need, listen, if you think more money is your greatest need, your life will end where chapter 6 ends. With your hands raised, with a perplexed look on your face, asking, what is the point? Now, there's a remedy for the problems of money. We find it at the end of chapter 5. It's just three short verses. Look at verse 18. Here is what I have seen to be good. See, this is in contrast to all of the tragedies. It is appropriate to eat, drink, and experience good in all the labor one does under the sun during the few days of his life. Notice, God has given him, because that is his reward. Further, everyone to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also allowed him to enjoy them, take his reward, and rejoice in his labor. This is a gift of God, for he does not consider the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with the joy of his heart. The remedy is God. What's been missing is God, or maybe to say it more accurately, what has been missing is living life attentive to what God has said and what God is doing. At the very center of this long passage on money, a passage that focuses on all the problems that money can bring, is a little island of hope. An island where God's will is sought and God's presence is acknowledged and God's goodness is celebrated. So the remedy for the problems of money is to find contentment in God's gifts, not in your financial gains. Gift, not gain. We saw this in chapter 2. We saw it again in chapter 4. What is good is to work hard at the task that God has given you to do, and then enjoy whatever blessings God gives you as a result of the work he's called you to do. What is good is to live our lives in relationship with him, to seek our joy and satisfaction in God, and to enjoy his gifts with open hands. Because the gifts are not what matters most. Even if the gifts evaporate, as Job said, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, but blessed is the name of the Lord. We know the giver. We walk with the giver. The remedy here is summarized by the writer of Hebrews in Hebrews 13, verse 5. He writes, keep your life free from the love of money. Be satisfied with what you have. Notice this. For he himself has said, he does not say, I will provide everything you need. That's not the promise. That's the promise you expect, isn't it? Be satisfied with what you have because God will provide everything you need. He says something even better. Be satisfied with what you have, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Don't love money, but be content. Understand that the real treasure is knowing God. The more you value God, the more you delight in God, the more joy you'll find in the gifts that God has given you. Three times in this passage we find the word gift or given. Seeing everything you have as a gift from God changes everything. Nothing you have in your possession is because you earned it. You may think you have it because you worked hard, but that is not the case. You have it because God gave it to you. I have visited other countries, and I have seen people that work harder than me and work harder than you. You know how I know it? Because they look about 20 years older than they are. Their backs are stooped, their hands are gnarled, their faces are prematurely aged. And the reason you have more than they have is not because you're a harder worker or because you're more talented or because you're smarter. It's because God has given it to you, bottom line. That's it. Now notice, in the midst of this broken and fallen world that we live in, a world that's broken and fallen because humans tried to replace God with his stuff, it says, God in his kindness, verse 20, gives us gifts to enjoy. Because with all the brokenness around us, it would be easy for us to just sit there miserable all the time. I mean, this week we saw, again, more heartbreak, more tragedy, and it's overwhelming. And this isn't a type of escapism. That's not what it's talking about. It's just showing us God's kindness to us. That he gives us gifts, verse 20, so that we're not so overwhelmed by all the brokenness, but we get to enjoy him in the gifts he's given us. See, if we were gloomy all the time, we would reveal something about our Father which is not true. Like, God is happy. Do you believe that God is happy? Infinitely, perfectly happy. And he created us and he made this world so that we would join in his happiness. So enjoying his kindness is a way we celebrate his love. But listen, the ability to enjoy his gifts, to be content with his work in us, is also a gift from him. Like all the possible joys around us, all the things that we think would bring us happiness, would make us satisfied, would be content if we just have those, all of those are like gifts under the Christmas tree. Batteries are not included. No gift in this world comes with the power to enjoy the gift itself. Everything comes powerless. You see, the gift comes and then God gives us the power to enjoy the gift. The power is God's grace at work in us. That's what it says in chapter 6, verse 2. So, the Apostle Paul famously said, right, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He was not talking about CrossFit, and he was not talking about college exams. He was talking about contentment. Like, it is only if God does a work of grace in my heart through Jesus Christ that I can be content with what he's given me. Because in that same passage, he says, I know how to be abased. I know how to abound. I know what it means to suffer. I know what it means to rejoice. I can do all things. I can be content through Christ in me. Three times in verses 18 through 20, we find gifts or given, and three times we find some version of the word joy. I mean, I want you to see this. God wants his people to enjoy his world. It is why he made it. But we cannot enjoy it apart from him. This is our tragic mistake. This is the sickening tragedy. Trying to make and find joy in a world made for joy in God, trying to find it apart from God. When we come to God through Jesus Christ and we walk with him by faith, then we can find joy and satisfaction. Money is a terrible savior. You don't need money to fix your problems. You need Jesus. In Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, one of the tales is about three young men who decide they're going to go on a quest to kill death. So they start on the quest, they meet an old man, and they ask him where they can find death. And he says, over there under a tree. Well, they go there, and under the tree they don't find death, they find a treasure. And all of a sudden, their quest is forgotten. And they start thinking about this treasure and how they want this treasure. And so they make a plan that we're going to stay here till it gets dark, and then we'll haul off the treasure so no one sees it so we can keep it for ourselves. Well, since they'll be there a while, one of the men volunteers to go into the nearby town to get some food and wine to bring it back while they wait. While he's there, he starts thinking. He's like, you know, that treasure's great, but it'd be better if I didn't have to split it three ways. And so not only does he buy food and wine, he buys food and wine and poison, and he poisons the wine. Well, while he's gone in the town getting the food and wine, the other two guys start talking, and they say, you know, this treasure's great, but it'd be better if we didn't have to split it three ways. So when he gets back, we'll surprise him and we'll kill him, and now we can only have to share it, split it two ways. And so when he returns from the village, that's what they do. They surprise him, they kill him, and then to celebrate, they drink the wine. So they sought out to find death, but death found them, and he found them with a treasure. That tale reminds me of Adam and Eve, our first parents, who found death under a tree as well. They thought they found a treasure that could satisfy them apart from God, and taking it for themselves, they died, and we are just like them. We are just like them, that we continue to seek joy and seek freedom and seek satisfaction apart from God. And one of the ways we do it is to take what he gives us, to take the resources, to take all that he provides and try to replace him. And in doing so, we find death. But on another tree, thousands of years later, the Son of God sought out death, and obeying death, he killed death for us. Right under that tree, he drank the full cup of suffering our sin deserves, and he died in our place so that sin no longer has dominion over us. And now what Jesus invites us to do is he invites us to enjoy what he gives us, not apart from him, but with him. You see, four times he tells us a tragedy, but it's really just one tragedy. And it's the greatest tragedy. The greatest tragedy is to get everything you desire just to find out it doesn't matter. This is the point of Jesus' question when he asked, "For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul?" Are you trying to gain the whole world at the cost of your soul? Father, help us to see what's truly motivating us. I know in my own heart it's easy to agree with what the Word has told us today. It's a lot harder to honestly, with the help of your Spirit, evaluate how I live. Lord, we need your help. We so desperately need your help. But help us to see, as we sang not long ago, that our worth is not in what we own. It's found in the cross. And that's what allows us to rejoice in our Redeemer, our greatest treasure. So, Father, help us. Help us to see what's true and help us to turn in faith to you, and then give us contentment through Jesus Christ. I pray this in his name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message from Redeemer Community Church in Fuquay-Varina, North Carolina. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. For more sermons, we invite you to visit us online at redeemernc.org.